151-150 is repealed. Materials in here, is there anyone that wishes to testify on this bill? Please come forward, Attorney General's office, Attorney General. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gail Horetzky. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division in the Department of Law. I would urge, Mr. Chairman, your favorable consideration of House Bill 121. Just a very brief background, the provision that we're repealing in this bill dated from the turn of the century and was an old provision that related to common law. At common law, there was generally recognized a right for a private person to bring a criminal action. In Alaska, however, in 1949, in Title 44 was adopted the statute that gave the Attorney General exclusive authority to prosecute violations of criminal offenses on behalf of the state. This other provision, which deals with the payment of costs by someone who appears and signs out a complaint maliciously, was not repealed at the time that the Attorney General statute was passed in 1949. It's been sort of sitting quietly on the books for just under 100 years. That hasn't caused us any problems, except just recently, this statute, which because of its age is not very clearly drafted, probably is a violation of due process on its face, has been read by some laypeople, most recently in the Kenai Peninsula area, to grant them a right to file criminal charges against whomever they want to. And it's been used a handful of times mainly to file charges against police officers who have arrested these people. And the court system asked us, because this was becoming a problem, if we would, on behalf of them, submit a bill to be drafted and submit it to the governor for submission to you so that this obsolete provision, which has led to a great deal of confusion recently, would be repealed. So it would be very clear that it is only the state, on behalf of the public, which has the right to file criminal charges against private individuals. And I'd be glad, Mr. Chairman, to answer any questions if there are any.
Other questions of the witness?
Well, I'm not sure I understand it.
Maybe Hayden's question will lead to our understanding. Mr. Kate?
Through the chair, what were the cases of Kenai that presented the problem? I mean, why, it seems like I've heard of situations where there has not been prosecution and people felt wrong and felt like they had no place else to go. So if you take away this right or privilege, as the case may be, to bring an action, you know, by a private individual, what recourse might they have?
Mr. Chairman, it's the position of the Attorney General's office, and always has been the position of the Attorney General's office, that there is no such thing as a, quote, "private prosecutor" in the state of Alaska. Not anymore. The kinds of cases that have been brought in Kenai have been for alleged assaults, trespasses, violation of civil rights, that sort of thing, where an officer will go on a person's property in order to serve an arrest warrant. And the person is hauled off down to jail, and he or she is upset by being arrested, and they turn around and go down to the court the next day and attempt to file criminal charges against the police officer who arrested him. How this has been being handled is one of two ways, depending on what locality it's been filed in. In some localities, the clerks refuse to accept them, and that's fine, and it just goes away. In some cases, the clerk takes in a piece of paper and stamps it with a number, and then administratively, we have to do something to close out that file because the court system has a number that's been assigned. So what we have been doing is just been having the DA file a dismissal, and then the court closes out the file and the jacket is filed away in the closed case bin. I would submit, Mr. Chairman, not only is there no such thing as a private prosecutor, that it would be a very poor policy decision by this body to allow such a thing as a private prosecutor because private people are not bound by the same code of ethics that attorneys are. They're not officers of the court. They are not familiar with requirements about, for example, turning over exculpatory evidence. They don't understand discovery. And you would have conceivably neighbors who were in disputes with each other over boundary lines, payment of debts, whether somebody was seeing somebody else's daughter's girlfriend, something like that, filing cross criminal charges against each other left and right. I think that especially for public officials, judges, police officers, elected officials, people of prominence in the community, the filing of a criminal charge against somebody could have a tremendously adverse effect on that person's reputation, standing in the community, employment opportunities, etc. Even if 6 months later the charge were dismissed or something like that, the damage would be done in terms of a person's reputation. I submit that there is no such thing as a private prosecutor, and the creation of such an office would be a very poor public policy.
Senator?
Does the Office of Private Prosecutor exist in other jurisdictions?
Mr. Chairman, the many states had statutes which explicitly allowed, quote, private prosecutions. And almost all of the states which had those kind of statutes repealed them. In some states, they were struck down by the courts with the developing notion of due process and the sovereign. They just said, this doesn't apply anymore. It contradicts with other statutes, and they did away with it judicially. We have never had a statute which created such an office or such a power. This statute here was passed in recognition of the existence at common law of such a scheme, but there was never a specific statute which authorized it. And if you look at this statute, it talks about a person who voluntarily appears, his name shall be endorsed on the complaint. If it's found to be malicious, the fact shall be entered in by the magistrate. It never says a person can prosecute privately. It just says this is the procedure that happens if somebody does this and it's malicious, then you have to pay costs. And it's a costs section, really, than a private prosecutor section.
How does this relate to the budget reductions? I mean, I would think at first glance that the Department of Law would welcome, a citizen initiative where you were out of prosecutors or, Neighborhood Watch writ large.
Well, I guess all I could do is repeat some of the things that I have already stated. We feel very strongly that the filing of criminal charges against any person is a very serious matter. It's not to be undertaken lightly and should be taken only if there's sufficient admissible evidence to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt of every essential element of the offense. And your average layperson who is angry at his neighbor or a merchant down the block is not going to stop to make that evaluation of the evidence, the elements of the offense, etc., nor is he going to be aware of legal obligations regarding evidence, procedure, inadmissible evidence, that sort of thing. I think it would be a nightmare, both as a policy matter and as an administrative matter.
Senator Rohde?
Madam Chairman, if I can follow up on Senator Jodison's question. As I read the statute, the first sentence of the statute that we're repealing seems to be a very clear authority for a private prosecutor. It says, the name of a person who voluntarily appears before a judge, magistrate, or grand jury to prosecute a person in a criminal action, either for a misdemeanor or a felony, shall be endorsed upon the complaint, comma, information, or indictment as a private prosecutor, period. That seems to be ample authority. And if we're going to deal with the cost section, I'm arguing, but it seems that the statute, and I understand the position of the Department of Law, but it seems that the statute fairly clearly on its face authorizes private prosecution.
Mr. Chairman, you probably haven't had a chance, I'm sure, Senator, to read the transmittal letter, but we go into this in fairly great detail in that because it is confusing. The present statute was based on a 1982 statute from Oregon. Based on my research, the first time it appears in the Alaska statute is in 1900, and it remains unchanged from 1900 until today, except for minor technical changes. For example, when they revised the magistrate system, they went through and stuck judge in the statute in four places. It wasn't, it wasn't a substantive change. It was a technical conforming amendment. So except for those kind of changes, it's remained in its present form since 1900. The important thing from our point of view, Senator, is that in 1949, the legislature adopted a statute, 4423.020, and in that statute, subsection B3 specifically, that statute says, and I quote, the responsibility to prosecute all cases involving violation of state law is vested in the Attorney General. So our position is that there is a conflict to the extent that 1245-140 appears to authorize this, and I think you and I may be disagreeing on the interpretation of that language, but to the extent that that position can be taken, I would submit that it conflicts with a more recently adopted statute giving the Attorney General exclusively that power. And it is because of this confusion that we are seeking to have the statute repealed.
Senator Josephson.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, repeals by implication are not favored, and it could be a reference to simply placing the duty in the office of the Attorney General as regards other state agencies, I mean, and not as to private persons. Has this statute been used? You mentioned the vulnerability of public officials. Has this statute been used to bring about a private prosecution of, I think that the background material says of an officer, it has been used for false arrest, malicious prosecution type of situation. Has it been used against officers of the Department of Law or the court system?
Well, when you say used, you mean if someone attempted to file a piece of paper?
Has there been an attempt by an individual to bring a criminal charge against a representative of your department or the court system?
I think at one point there was an attempt in Kenai to file a complaint against the DA there, who's Thomas Bordell, but I'm not sure about that. I'm sure that the main topic has been police officers, you know, the main target has been police officers. But it seems to me at some point there was mention that someone had tried to do it. Now, whether it was ever accepted by the court clerk, that I'm afraid I couldn't answer.
Madam Chair, I just note that both in 1962 and in 1971, in both of those times, this statute appeared in the state laws for that year with apparently no objection from anybody in the legislature, both bodies voting on it. I don't necessarily debate whether we should do it or not, but I read the statute as authorizing it.
I must apologize to the committee. We've lost the chairman. You're losing your vice chairman because I have a bill that's up. Would you care to continue, Senator? And you have the conspiracy bill. People ready to testify on that as soon as you're completed here. Okay? Not sure.
Senator Josephson. I think the committee might disagree over the characterization of the statute as to whether it's desirable to have that statute repealed and to put it in conformity and make a policy decision on whether the Attorney General should be the only person in the state to bring a criminal action. Counsel?
I raise a situation in the federal RICO statutes. There is a provision in that for private prosecution, and it's presently being used to prosecute many of the key players in the Iran Watergate scandal. And it's been filed, and it's statutory. But it has withstood two challenges in court so far, attempts to dismiss. So it is being used where government agency refuses because of politics or other reasons to bring a criminal action where one theoretically should be filed.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, that's a prosecution only in a common dictionary sense. It's not a criminal prosecution.
It's civil.
I think so.
They use the RICO statute.
It's like
a criminal acts as a basis for a civil judgment, and there has to be a pattern of them, and it can't be just a single act, it has to be at least two. And
it's analogous.
It's treble damages.
It's analogous to the antitrust.
And of course, your department has endorsed the RICO statute as a tool that you would wish to use in dealing with criminal activity in the state of Alaska.
Yeah. I guess I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, I think that I know what Gail is saying, and the overwhelming portion of cases, this would probably be used, frankly, by very eccentric people who do not have a legal understanding. And yet there is that case where, as you say, somebody might really feel aggrieved and be the only person who can bring the matter out. It should be brought out.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might, obviously a person who felt very aggrieved would always have a civil action at law.
If they had
they may not have the satisfaction of putting someone in jail, if that's what they're...
They might or might not. If they would, they would have to show damages different from the rest of the society to make a civil claim. They couldn't vindicate a public wrong through a private right of action unless there was private damage. But there is something else that I would say if I were in your position, which is that since the statute was adopted, there is the State Ombudsman's Office, there is the Public Offices Commission, there are a lot of places now that didn't exist in 1900 where you can go to try to vindicate...
Consumer Protection Division.
Consumer Protection Division.
The other argument, of course, on behalf of the Attorney General is that large and powerful economic interests could, of course, fund this type of activity, could use it. The one thing that comes to mind is, of course, in the days when the statute was repealed, would be the possible action by the various Seattle fishing groups with regard to some of the fishing disputes that took place, particularly in Southeast Alaska, and weren't prosecuted by federal officials at the time.
There's also the Executive Ethics Code now that applies to public officers, where an individual can make a complaint.
Sounds like you've got yourself in.
Yeah, I don't have it.
Obviously, we can't move a bill until
possibly
we have some more members present. But
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
27. I'd say that there's only like a half hour time limit or something.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. I move out the marijuana bill. Oh, there's no quorum. I'm sorry.
I'll do that.
Next year.
Council, are there other bills that there are people here to, as the sponsor of the next bill that 27 is to be up there, several police officers and others that want to testify before the House on here. Is there something else that we have on the agenda?
Well, we had Senator Farrington just next door, 153.
Maybe we should. I don't know what Mr. Pertillo is on.
I don't know. He didn't think it would be too long.
Do you want to take a 5-minute break?
Perhaps it's the best
well,
thing.
Well, we got people waiting on telecopter. You could take testimony.
Okay.
You know, and then you've got the local people you can bring in after. Okay. Telecopter's testimony. I mean,
is this testimony on conspiracy?
Yeah.
This is a conspiracy testimony. It'd be nice to have the three votes here to deal with it, but
I don't put you.
I won't usurp Senator Catullus' authority and your Senate Bill 53, even though it appears to be a non-controversial bill. This time, I would like to bring up Senate Bill 27 relating to the crime of conspiracy. And then, are we online?
We're online. Anchorage and people ready to testify right here. Yes, we're just about ready to start here.
This is Senator Pat Rohde. I'm conducting the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting, and Senator Catullo is absent from the room. We have several people to testify. The first person on my list is Fred Morgan. Mr. Morgan, are you on the other end of the line?
Senator, he's approaching the mic right now. Yeah, hello, Pat. Yeah, now I am. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Fred.
Good.
Well, I went through this whole bill, Pat, and as I get the picture, it seems like it's talking about not only conspiracy. I had a question over here somewhere, but I think I saw it on page 2 at the bottom there, line 25 or 6. It talks about Class A felonies and so on, but that's just mostly legal classification and so on.
Right, but those are in the statute now, Fred.
Bill, I think, besides writing her on conspiracy, seems to be to kind of clamp down on prostitution as such, and maybe controlled substances such as drugs and so on. Is this about the case, as you understand it?
Yes, I'm the author of the bill, Fred. It essentially allows a crime of conspiracy to be used in cases relating to drugs and prostitution. Those cases where evidence is very difficult to get, and most often individuals are used to insulate those people who actually run the operations from those.
And in effect, it, I guess, gives the prosecutor a little extra tool to fight his case. Yeah, I saw your name at the top there, plus some others. Yeah, well, offhand, I would say give it a due pass, and I guess that's about all I have on that score. Any questions?
No, I appreciate your comments very much, Brett. Thank you.
Okay.
See.
I don't have it.
The next person I have on the list to testify is Mr. Stearns.
Mr. Stearns is approaching the mic.
Thank you very much for being here today. I appreciate any comments you have.
There are two comments I'd like to make for your consideration. In reviewing these bills, I noticed two things that I'd like to at least bring to your attention. One is it appears that it deals with the narcotics section. Excuse me, just a second. 1171.010 through 1171.050. And I would certainly encourage the committee to consider Chapter 73, 1173.010 to 1173.040, which is the Imitation Control of Substances Act, to be part of this legislation. The second thing that I would encourage the committee to consider would be the area of forfeiture concerning the conspiracy statute or bill. The idea that the conspiracy is going to be used in the areas of available forfeitures for the state, I would think that, like we see in 1173.060, that would be a consideration of similar wording in the conspiracy area. And that would be my major two concerns, and I certainly would entertain any questions that the committee would have concerning certainly the drug enforcement areas in this bill.
One question from myself, Lieutenant Stearns. Is there as great a danger in the imitation substance area as there is in the actual narcotics area?
I'm sorry, sir. Could you ask it one more time? I was looking at a word and I didn't pick it all up.
Is there the same degree of activity by drug dealers in the area of controlled substances as there is in the area of imitation substances? Are the two situations similar?
With the use of the conspiracy situation, I would say yes. Obviously, we're seeing a great deal more dealing in cocaine and heroin and the rest of those substances. When we take a look at the imitation control substances, what we're seeing is a real moneymaker, and we're seeing the idea, and I'll give you an example of a case that we had where conspiracy, I consider the conspiracy issue a preventative issue. Otherwise, we don't have to let the act continue on with any harmful effects if we get into it immediately under the bill as you have it here. We have an adult who is purchasing 10,000 hits of fake speed for $100. That adult then recruits a 17-year-old, a 16-year-old, and four 14-year-olds to sell that speed in a local high school for $3 to $5 a hit. The profit is tremendous. We now have to let that controlled substance, or the imitation controlled substance, we have to let that come in, and we have to let that be used and or dealt out to complete the act where we then can go after that person. An effective conspiracy would stop that completely. So I hate to put a degree of seriousness on it. I think that those things that warranted Chapter 73 to come into statute would probably warrant, in the instance that we can use it, this conspiracy bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Stearns. Are there any other questions for members of the Judiciary Committee? It appears there are no other questions. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
I only have two individuals on my list to testify. Is there anyone else on the teleconference that wishes to testify at this time?
There's no one else here in Anchorage.
If there is no one else to testify, then we'll proceed with the matters here in the Judiciary Committee. Senator Petrullo.
Thank you very much. There's Officer Farginder, or something like that.
Yes.
Should I go get him? He's a hospital.
Yes.
Do you want to continue?
Are there other people here to testify at this time?
Yes. There are several.
Is he the only one down
there? He's perhaps one of the best. That was the question that was raised the last time we heard this bill, was the...
those individuals aren't here right now.
The efficacy of the bill, they're...
House Judiciary.
Oh, I see. And they're testifying at this time, House Judiciary?
My understanding from counsel is that he's going to try and get them right now.
Yes, Officer Feininger is one of the individuals.
Is it possible that Senator Rohde on Senate Bill 79, did you have Sacrilegious Runaway Missing Minors?
There were a number of people.
Are there people here testifying on that bill? Maybe I hadn't done mix apples and oranges together right now.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
With regard to CSSB 27.
Yes, sir.
I'm bothered by Section C1, unless it's explained to me, which says that in a prosecution under this section, it is not a defense that the defendant belongs to a class of persons who, by definition, are legally incapable in an individual capacity of committing a crime that is an object of the conspiracy. What does that relate to? Does that relate to, for example, someone who is not of legal age, or does it relate to a person who is mentally incompetent to know the nature of the act? What are we doing there?
Beth, did Hayden work on this?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Caden did work on it. However, that is verbatim out of the original bill, and the CS really didn't deal with much of the substance of the bill. It just dealt with the offenses that we were going to cover with the act of conspiracy.
Maybe Senator Rohde then, or
Mr. Chairman, when the bill was originally drafted, that was. It was drafted with the Department. Well, I looked around. Ms. Reske is not here at this time. I do not believe that it refers to persons of diminished capacity.
My presumption is, and we can get a comment from the Department of Law with regard, but there are obviously instances where someone would not be completely capable of selling drugs or something, or another crime, or in the case.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
you have floor.
If you look at C2, I can understand the rationale for that if you are in a conspiracy with someone else to commit a crime involving drugs, but that person is mentally incompetent or a minor, the other person's circumstances should not necessarily relieve you from punishment if you are using that person as a tool to perpetrate the offense.
You get
that's the anti-Fagan provision, I guess. But the first part relates to the defendant's own capacity, and I really would like an explanation of that.
Yeah, she could come in a couple minutes. The officer that wishes to testify on 27, if you can get Betty Fahrenkamp now, it'll be fine, wishes to testify on Senate Bill 27 is still on the stand there.
Let me see if I can call Gail Horesky and have her work on conjunction with their office on this, and let me see if I can.
It's fine. Are you going to top this question?
On the phone.
Sure.
She's doing it.
Okay. Let Pat do it.
I'll just walk down the
way. Yeah.
So you'll hold that.
Yeah, we'll hold 27 for this period.
She's on her way in.
Was there action on 121, or was there a question, further question on 121?
We didn't have enough people inside.
Did you want to move that one?
Yeah, if there's no objection, why don't we move House Bill 121?
Yeah, I move we report House Bill 121 with individual recommendations.
Without objection, so ordered.
Like musical chairs.
We're awaiting Senator Fahrenkamp's
arrival,
and I understand she's going to be here in just a moment. Thank you very much. Senator Fahrenkamp, if you will join us.
We had quite a discussion.
People are moving in and out of here, Senator Fahrenkamp, and so are members of the committee to testify before budget and so on. So we appreciate your coming at this time. I'm sorry if you would be a little bit hesitant, perhaps, and maybe even slow to ask questions here as we get into this legislation. Senate Bill 153 is before us by Senator Fahrenkamp, and it's an act relating to the penalty imposed for certain traffic offenses. And Senator Fahrenkamp, you have the floor.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I think all of you know, as an old teacher, I'm much more prone to support the carrot approach rather than the stick approach when it comes to trying to encourage a safety measure that people should abide by. And I was very much hoping that despite or no matter what happens with other legislation in this area, that we would encourage people to use their seatbelts. Through the use of a reduction in fine when there is a violation. Now, we were asked by the courts to look at other aspects to put into the bill of infractions and those kinds of things, but we don't want to get into where it's jail terms and those kinds of fines. What we had in mind with this legislation was strictly those instances in which people are stopped, you know, for a speeding violation or not having showing too much white on their taillights, or whatever the situation might be, that in those instances, those people who have their seatbelt fastened would then be given a break on their rewarded rather than punished for not having it. Now, one thing that comes up in all of this legislation, we know it's impossible to truly enforce this. Any type of seatbelt legislation. And people have been saying, well, what if somebody just buttoned their seatbelt? Well, what the heck? What if somebody in a wreck reaches over and half dead buttons their seatbelt? I mean, There's no way I can answer that. However, I think in most instances, you're spotted long before they're picked up for either speeding or too much white on the back or no brakes or whatever the running the stop sign or whatever the situation might be. And I would encourage this committee to support the concept of reward for protecting a person's own safety.
Yes, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fahrenkamp, the court system sent through a letter pointing out a couple of problems, saying that it appeared on the face to apply only to infractions. However, there are some misdemeanors that are considered too, and they suggested changing it to offense. And I wondered how you felt about that.
Well, as I said, we looked at that, and we certainly, you know, I don't care if it's a reward someplace else. That my problem is that I don't want to get into the court system of fines to where it affects any of that court business. They know more about that than I do. And in this, we said only the municipality of Anchorage has requested that the Supreme Court set the bail schedules for them. The other municipalities have simply ignored it, and so it's just, it'd be up to this committee, and I have no problems one way or the other.
Are there further questions, Senator Fahrenkamp?
I don't know, I don't believe you have this information in your packets. I'll be happy to share it with you if you want. It's just addresses a bit the enforceability, the applicability, the coverage, what's being done in some other states, in case you're of some interest.
Beth, did you have a question?
I didn't have a question. I simply had a comment that related to Senator Strzelczyk's question. And that is, if you broaden the bill to truly cover all offenses, you'll probably take in DWIs and every other kind of driving offense.
Okay.
And that's probably something that...
Well, I want to stay away
from want to get into that.
That would be my opinion.
Are there any further questions of the witness? Senator Fahrenkamp?
I appreciate your time, Mr. Chairman, and hearing the bill.
Is there a motion on this bill?
I move the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection. Senate Bill 153 is moved out of judiciary with individual recommendations. There are a number of people who wish to testify to this bill, but I suggest that it would probably be best now that they should go when it goes before finance, since the bill has moved out and we have a long calendar. As a rule, we would invite others. As a matter of fact, it does. Does any person wish to testify on this bill? Since it's out of committee.
What's the name of the bill?
Excuse me?
What's the number?
State the name.
It is, just was handed to me now. There were others that wish to testify on Senate Bill 153, a bill we just put out of committee. But I think most of their interest, save one, was to support the legislation. So this is the first time I haven't allowed witnesses to testify. But due to the exigencies of time and the confusions today, as long as no one is objecting to not having that opportunity, the bill is passed out of committee. The next committee will be rules. For us at this time, we return to Senate Bill 27. Are there members here now that can testify on Senate Bill 27? Senator Rohde.
Yes, if I could respond to Senator Josephson's question, I did, Richard, the question raised by Senator Josephson was the language states in C that in a prosecution under this section, it is not a defense that the defendant belongs to a class of persons who, by definition, are legally incapable on an individual capacity of committing a crime that is the object of a conspiracy. The best example that the Attorney General could give me was subject A would go to someone who is mentally incompetent, pay the money, and direct them to kill a third person. That person is not chargeable with the act of murder himself or herself. But they would be charged with the crime of conspiring to murder. The person to whom the other person who is legally incapable would, of course, not be chargeable because they would not have the requisite mental capacity under the statutes. That is the reason for it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
That is the argument for C2, which I agree with.
For C1.
C1 is where the defendant himself is legally incapable. C2 is where the defendant goes to a person who is legally incapable and employs or invites that person to commit the offense.
Well, if I could respond, Mr. Chairman, the offense being prosecuted is one of conspiracy, and the defense would run both to the conspirator and the actor that the conspirator had conspired with. Does that make sense?
Maybe I'm not making myself clear. I want to avoid is a situation
where someone who was incompetent being prosecuted. Bear in mind that the prosecution here is on conspiracy, not on the act itself. On the act itself, the defendant is immune from prosecution because they are incompetent.
Well, if you're saying, Mr. Chairman, through the chair,
yeah, of course.
Could you restate?
If the argument is that it's okay to prosecute a mentally incompetent person who could not be charged with a criminal act on the basis that he or she is only having a discussion with somebody and involved in a conspiracy, then I object to that. I think the same immunity from prosecution should apply to that person in a conspiracy charge or in an overt act situation. I guess this is a matter of taste.
Through the chair, that would be dealt with insanity law, which this committee several years ago narrowed considerably. You have to have two people for a conspiracy, and
one lawyer.
And
if I'm right, yeah. Maybe I'm wrong, but is the theory on this that you can't commit the end act? You're a paraplegic. You can't, legally, you're incapacitated to shoot a gun, but that you've conspired with another person.
No. Okay. They're talking about a legal incapacity here, not a physical incapacity. And a legal incapacity to me means that you're 12 years old and you can't be prosecuted. But are you saying that person is susceptible to prosecution for conspiracy?
There are other people that wish to testify now, and we should accommodate that this time. And I am very apologetic. The first person is Robert, and I cannot read the last name. I hate that because I says, please come forward. And if you will identify yourself and any group you may be representing or yourself, please do so, and you may have the floor.
Yes, my name is Robert Carl. I'm representing the victim's fly-in, and I'm here concerning about the conspiracy bill and funding for public safety. And I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic, and I started using drugs at the age of 13, and my drug addiction grew rapidly because of the fact that it was easy to get drugs. And I started dealing when I was 15, and that was to support my habit too. And at this time, I was going through DFYS, manipulating them towards my benefit. And my parents were getting, having lots of problems with them, and they wanted me to go into a drug treatment, but we kept on, DFYS kept on making up excuses about it. And I feel that we need the conspiracy bill and more funding for the public safety, not less.
Thank you very much. Questions of this witness? Thank you again, Robert. Thank you for coming forward. This time, Commissioner Burton, Richard Burton, if you'll come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to see you again.
Good to see you again.
I haven't sat at a table with you in a long time. I'm representing the Anchorage Crime Commission and the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce. We had with some of the others here, or conspiracy was a nasty word. The chamber lodged this bill. It's a great start. We'd like to see a general conspiracy because there are other things that have a high impact on all of us, people that conspire and you can't get to, besides drugs and prostitution, although particularly in Anchorage it's a considerable effort. But there are a lot of things that Alaska has become, unfortunately, sophisticated to the point, I think, in a lot of the homicides, a lot of the pornography, you know, a lot of things that are below the surface. If you have time to talk to some of these people, came to the thick and flying while I'm here, we'll get a deeper appreciation for it. We just spent some time with the governor, and I hope it had some impact. But I'll give my full support to this bill if that's all we could get, but we would certainly go for a general conspiracy, and I know there's not a chance of a snowstorm in Juneau today. I'm getting that probably out. But that's, to keep it short, representing the Anchorage Crime Commission and the Anchorage Legislative Committee for the Chamber of Commerce, I've been given their blessing to come down and say, you know, let's go for it, and we really support it very strongly.
Are there questions, Commissioner Burton? Marshall, do you have questions? We may have another question. Dick can still be here. Well, this best testimony.
We'll be here a couple of days. Unfortunately, some people don't want, but I'll be around.
I'm glad to see you.
I'll be around.
By and have a cup of coffee.
I will. Thank you, sir.
I'm going to ask again the next witness, an Anchorage Juvenile Crime Commission.
I'm sorry, I can't help you.
There's another witness that please come forward.
Lives on Snow Line, though.
Is that mine? Oh, it's yours. Okay. My lousy handwriting.
I know. Well, it's an improvement on mine, I have to admit.
It's beautiful, but you just can't read it.
You just can't read it. We'll keep it a big secret. Hi, my name is Teresa Johnson, and I am also with the Victims Fly-In and from the Anchorage School District. My capacity with the Anchorage School District is the program administrator for all the secondary drug and alcohol programs. So I have very, very broad exposure to the young people in the Anchorage School District. And I would like to just briefly give my support to the conspiracy bill on behalf of adolescents. My biggest concern as we work with our young people and try to do intervention work, much like Rob described his personal experience, is that many of these kids are preyed upon by other adults. And what we hear from the kids all the time is that they do a lot of the running around and the selling of drugs and get involved in prostitution and those kinds of things because the adults in the community that really make the big bucks know that the kids are only going to get a slap on the hand, so they look for those kinds of kids and conspire with them. And then if the kids get picked up for dealing, they get the juvenile court process where they get several chances to be reformed, but nobody ever taps into the adults. And so I'm real concerned about that particular viewpoint and would really ask you to give great consideration to supporting the conspiracy bill to protect our young people. And I also agree with Commissioner Burton, it would be nice if we could get general conspiracy, but if drugs and prostitution are our first primary targets, I'm all for it. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Thank you very, very much. Was the police officer here now, Mr. Caden?
Yes.
Right, you please come forward and identify yourself. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Senators on the committee, I'm Frank Feitinger. I'm with the Anchorage Police Department, and I'm assigned to the Exploited Child Unit at the Anchorage Police Department. I'd like to express to you my support for the conspiracy statute. It's a statute that we need. I, like Commissioner Burton, would like to see a general conspiracy statute. Many of the things that we deal with as policemen, both in my particular specialty area, dealing with children who have been exploited in one way or another, as well as dealing with the narcotics and drug structures, organized crime, and white-collar crime, requires, as a tool, that we be able to use the conspiracy concept to get at those people who are the organizers, but not the doers. And presently, that's very difficult to do, if not impossible to do. So in effect, even with the limited resources that we have, we are spending most of our time in all areas of investigation attacking those persons who are actually selling drugs, running prostitution, getting involved in other types of criminal activity where other persons are actually victimized in their criminal activity by those who are organizing, those who are profiting the most from it. And these people are virtually impossible for us to touch under our present legal system. I think for that reason is why we need to look seriously at general conspiracy and in specific these statutes that are here today. I would like to, at the risk of offending Commissioner Burton, I think times have changed a lot in Alaska. I remember 13 years ago when I first met Commissioner Burton, I was a young trooper then. I hadn't even become a trooper then. And Commissioner Burton talked to us about the state of crime in Alaska, and he told us at that time that there was not much when it came to organized crime in Alaska. I see today that Commissioner Burton, like the rest of us that have dealt in police work, have come to the state where we realize that this is in fact not the case, that we are affected by organized criminal activity, and we need a way to get at it. Right now we don't have it.
Mr. Chairman?
You have four cents, Mr.
Chairman, thank you. Frank, I support this, but I wonder if you could tell us just a few instances, and I don't mean actual cases, but what kinds of things happen that you're not able to get at? Is it, well, I'll just stop with that and ask if you could say, you know, the kind of organization and why you're not able to go for it. I guess the basic bottom line is, why do we need a conspiracy?
Some of the most notable cases that have come up to date have dealt in the field of narcotics, where the persons that are actually selling the narcotics to one level of dealer or another, we can sometimes get at through conventional police techniques. However, those persons that are arranging for the importing of the narcotics, that are arranging for the rings of people that sell the narcotics and other types of illegal drugs, those are the people that we have difficulty getting at because they're not hands-on people. They're not the ones that are actually physically selling the contraband substance, but they are organizing groups below them that do that.
In other words, they would be pulled in by the actual doing of the crime. You would be able to link back, whereas under the current situation, you really have to go out to get the evidence against that person that's over here. Is that a
That's a pretty good overview, yes. Oh. Maybe to make it a little bit more specific, it's the kind of situation where, for example, in a illegal drug type of investigation where you might use an undercover agent, and that agent will gradually work his way up the chain of dealers that occur. And normally in these kinds of things, there's an insular structure. There's a structure, if you will, much like our governmental structures or private industry structures or whatnot, where some people are on the bottom pushing small amounts, and then there's people that are dealing to them and people that are dealing to them. Well, as we start to work our way up this level, we get to a point where we're no longer talking about a person who is physically handling the drugs, but who is physically arranging for these large-scale dealers to have access to whatever transportation facilities, sales facilities, or people that they need to have access to. Often we can penetrate these things using undercover techniques, but we have no statute to attack them with because they're not hands-on. In the area, another example comes to light in the area of prostitution, where for many years in Alaska, we dealt in Anchorage as well as several of the other major metropolitan area with a ring of persons operating out of the Washington State and Oregon State area, where females were imported into the state of Alaska for purposes of prostitution. We could not do anything with this, although we had lots of evidence. because, again, we had no way, they were not hands-on people. That's a couple of examples of where the conspiracy bill would help.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have Gloria Healy. Healy. The victims fly in. Gloria.
I'm Gloria Healy. I don't
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other people who wish to testify? Beth, would you explain the two versions quickly? Yes, are there further witnesses?
I wanted to testify, but I wanted to make a general statement that would include the conspiracy bill as well as Senate Bill 79 and increased public safety. Would that be an appropriate time now, or should I wait until Senate Bill 79 comes up?
No, I think that's appropriate. The lady behind you may wish to just testify to this bill. Do you have?
Yes, I think I've signed on both the bills on the other sheet, so.
Okay, can I have the other sheet? Yes. All right. All right. For this particular moment, Senate Bill 79 is before us, along with the other bill, because first, please identify yourself.
My name is Judy Rich, and I come to you today wearing several hats. First, I come to you representing the several hundred members of Tough Love, a support group for parents who are concerned about their teenagers' behavior. We have three chapters of Tough Love in Anchorage, one in Eagle River, one in the Kenai, and one in Wasilla. I also come to you as a citizen of this state who has become increasingly involved in runaway issues, drug issues, and sexual assault issues in our community. At this time, I would like to introduce to you my friend, Debbie Herai. Over here. Debbie is also representing the parents of Tough Love and is also involved in runaway, drug, and sexual assault issues. So what are two nice women doing in a place like this? We both have 16-year-old drug-addicted sons who have been runaways since the age of 13. Somehow that sounds distasteful, doesn't it? Look at us. Do we look respectable to you? Debbie is a good Catholic wife and mother with a background in primary education, grief counseling, and sexual assault counseling. She has been a full-time wife and mother. Her son attended Catholic parochial school. Her husband is a college graduate and works for an oil company. I am a former junior high school teacher with a counseling background. I volunteer for STAR. My ex-husband lives less than 2 miles from me and sees his children often. He is head of special education for the Anchorage School District. Our son was a wanted child, adopted when he was 5 days old. The Herai son was a wanted child. What better families for children to be raised in? But we are not unique. There are hundreds of wonderful families that Debbie and I have worked with through Tough Love whose children are on drugs and have run, who are not part of DFYS's statistics, who do not have a state agency to be their voice, and we need your help. There is a currently held myth that children who run are running from homes where they are either abused or not wanted. If you talk to representatives from DFYS, they will tell you that the number of children running from homes where they are wanted is so minuscule that it's not even worth talking about. This is simply not true. Every day I get referrals from the crisis line or from people who have heard of me by word of mouth that I can help them get their kids back or at least tell them what they can do when their kids have run. These are parents who are running appropriate homes. And what information do I have for them? I get to tell them one of three things. Number one, I can tell them that their children are correct, that their children can run, and that the parent can do nothing about it. Because in this state, children, no matter what age, have the right to choose where they want to live, even if they are putting themselves in extreme danger. Debbie's son chose to live with his pusher. Our current Tough Love group has two families whose daughters have chosen to live with their pimps. The second thing I get to tell them is that DFYS will not help you. If your child has not been abused, then they have no services for you and, in fact, don't wish to talk to you. I had a mother who called just yesterday seeking help for her daughter. DFYS hung up on her because her daughter had not been abused. No wonder their statistics show no caring parents who provide good homes, just abused and castaway children. Debbie and her husband have spent over $50,000 trying to help their drug-addicted son. My ex-husband and I have shared equally the over $50,000 in expenses, none of which is covered by insurance, to help our son. I know of many other parents who have spent the same and more. Does this sound like uncaring parents to you? The third thing I get to tell, if you want to get your child into the system so that you can get help, you'll have to get your child charged with a crime, preferably one committed against you, so that you can have some control. Then you may get some help through the probation office. What can you as legislators do to help us? First of all, we need Senate Bill 79. We as parents need to have a mechanism for ensuring the safety of our children. Although not perfect, Senate Bill 79 gives us a vehicle for getting our children off the street without having to charge them with a crime. I know you've all heard how harmful this bill will be to children who are running from abusive homes or who are castaways. I cannot believe that any rational person would believe that an abused child is better off on the streets. If anything, he is less safe than a child who has never been abused, as he has already been set up for abuse. That's how he expects to be treated. Senate Bill 79 also tells our children that they cannot just opt out. They must be part of the solution. They must start by making good decisions about where they will live. If not at home, then someplace safe and monitored. The bottom line for this state must be no child belongs on the street. Number two, we need increased funding for public safety. Most of the kids who have run from the structure of the home to the freedom of the streets are on drugs, in many cases drugs that are so readily available that kids don't even have to buy them. The proliferation of drugs in our society is so overwhelming it hardly bears thinking about, yet we are cutting the public safety budget so that statewide narcotics is being reduced from 20 officers to 6. 6 officers statewide to deal with drugs when there is increasing evidence that drug shipments from South America to our, It's increasing evidence that drug shipments from South America are being flown north to Canada and Alaska and then south to Seattle as outside enforcement agencies step up protection. 6 officers when we are seriously considering recriminalizing marijuana in this state. 6 officers when our most precious resources, our children, are at incredible risk. 6 officers to track drug movement from Anchorage to the valley and back. 6 officers to track drug movement from Anchorage to the bush. To put these 14 officers back into drug enforcement will cost $945,000. If you think that's a lot of money, you should speak to Debbie Herai's family and mine. Between the two of us, we've spent over $100,000 to rehabilitate 2 children. We're asking you for $945,000 to protect all the children of this state. And the third thing we need from you, we need a conspiracy bill, preferably one amended to include child exploitation. We want to get those people who plot to involve our children in drugs and prostitution to support their fancy lifestyles, particularly those most at risk, the runaway. I am a respectable citizen of this community. Mrs. Herai is also. So are the other members of Tough Love that we represent. We represent many wonderful parents. Look at what happened to our children. You gentlemen and lady look respectable also. Please give us the tools so what happened to our children does not happen to yours. Thank you very much.
Other questions or discussion? Thank you very much. I hope that you'll attempt to address Senate Finance on this issue of funding. I would just up their increasing funding in another category. And this is the time to be there.
It's
almost
right now?
Right now. They were on state police right at this moment.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Are there more people that wish to testify on Senate Bill 27? Now, that's the conspiracy statute. Dot Hayden, would you explain briefly on the version 1 and the version 2 on Senate Bill 27? We will take further testimony shortly, or before the end of the meeting, at least, on Senate Bill 79.
Mr. Chairman, these two versions, version 1 and 2, basically track committee substitute drafts that were submitted earlier in March. And
Gail, you can join us at the table as well.
Are you still on conspiracy?
We're back to conspiracy, and there was a question by Senator Joseph. However, I'm asking that Senator Mr. Caden That is.
I don't have version two. Does everybody have version two?
I do have version two. Is there an extra copy?
Use version two.
Thank you.
We have it.
Okay, there's a number of copies. In both of those, the prostitution, crime prostitution was removed. And in version one, the it was what has been done is made it the crime the object the crime object has to be a felony involving delivery of controlled substances. Version two was the same, except that the Schedule 6A controlled substances were removed, lesser. Those that were considered less dangerous drugs.
Excuse me.
Yes.
You say version one, the crime, which is the object of the conspiracy, must be a felony?
That's correct. Well, but in both of those.
Pardon?
Yes.
In both cases?
Both versions. That's correct.
Okay. But in but the list is longer in version one than version two. Is that
That's
right?
correct.
Now, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Why is the child exploitation or prostitution removed?
Well, child exploitation was never in.
It was never in my bill.
Okay.
So council was not to be addressed for why that.
Prostitution was.
That's it was at one point. Okay. It was just removed for sake of discussion, you know, to give you a number of options. There were, when the bill has come up before, there have been a number of objections to dealing with prostitution.
Does one include prostitution?
No,
neither
of them.
Neither.
Pardon? No subject included.
Okay.
Did you have a question that you may wish to address to Ms. Gresson?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions, Gail. I had one when you left. I have two now. If you look at page one of section one, subsection C,
I have two copies that she needs, and Betsy.
In a prosecution under this section, it is not a defense that the defendant belongs to a class of persons who, by definition, are legally incapable in an individual capacity of committing a crime that is an object of the conspiracy. What is your understanding of that language?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not certain of this because I haven't really had a chance to refresh my recollection on it. I can tell you where it came from. It's identical language that exists in the solicitation statute, which is an existing law. What I believe it means, Senator, and I want to emphasize, I haven't had a chance to go back through the commentary or do any research, is that if, for example, there is a statute that is passed to protect a class of people, such as minors, like the old statutory rape provision or contributing to the delinquency of a minor, something like that, that the minor himself or the minor herself could not be guilty of that crime, even if he or she solicited the commission of the crime, because it was a crime that was created to protect that class of people, i.e. minors. But I think that it would not be a defense to a charge of conspiracy to commit that crime that that person is among the protected class. He or she couldn't be charged and convicted of the underlying crime, but could be charged with conspiracy. Now, that's not an example that applies to this bill because, obviously, this bill is only prostitution and drugs, or at least some of the versions are only prostitution and drugs. But this is a general provision that is in a general conspiracy statute the same way that it appears in our general solicitation statute. And that's the only example I can think of that would fit the definition as I understand it.
Well, first of all, the existence of the solicitation statute indicates that some of these examples could be already covered by existing law.
That's right.
What I was getting at, though, going back to the nuts and bolts of this, is that literally read, this would mean that
If you are a mentally incompetent person or a minor who conspires with someone else to do a felony, commit a felony involving a controlled substance, in the conspiracy, as to the conspiracy charge, it would not be a defense that you were in the class of persons that is legally incapable of committing the crime.
Mr. Chairman, I disagree, Senator, because if you look back up to the essential elements of the crime, you have to have an intent to commit the crime, you have to have an agreement, and you have to have an overt act. So if a person was mentally impaired to where they couldn't form a specific intent to commit the crime, then he or she could not be charged with a conspiracy, regardless of subsection C.
Well, in the first place, I'm not sure that every mentally impaired person could not form the intent. I guess that's into a pretty esoteric area for me. But what about the minor situation? Could this language lead to the prosecution of a 17-year-old for conspiracy who could not be charged as a, well, I thought that's not true, might not be chargeable with as an adult with a felony case?
Mr. Chairman, I think that the intent of this provision is to allow a person who could not be charged with the underlying crime to nonetheless be charged with the conspiracy to commit that crime. I think that is the intent.
Okay, and what is their argument? What's the reason? I'd like to take you to page 3 also, since you're in the docket, or in the dock. If you look at page 3, line 12 and 13, this has to do with the statute of limitations. It says that conspiracy is a continuing course of conduct that terminates when the defendant informs law enforcement authorities of the existence of the conspiracy and of the defendant's participation in it. But if you go back to page 2, a voluntary and complete renunciation of the defendant's criminal intent with timely warning to law enforcement authorities is an affirmative defense to the charge. See what I'm saying? I think these might be read together, but I want to be sure that they're not inconsistent, I guess.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that they would be read together, but I think they address two different issues. One is the duration of the conspiracy, and the other is at what point does a person have an affirmative defense to a prosecution for conspiracy. And I think that people could get together and conspire to do a crime and then change their mind and walk away from it. And the law says there has to be a way to mark the end of that pattern of conspiracy, or that, you know, and they would, in the course of the conduct, if I can use that term. And that is for, like, purposes of the statute of limitations and stuff like that. But for a person who is actually charged with the crime, then the stuff on page 2, the subsection E there, says the circumstances under which a person who has been charged with the crime has an affirmative defense to those charges, saying, no, you cannot prosecute me for those because I meet the criteria of renunciation.
Okay, and I suppose you could have situations, you will have situations, where someone informs law enforcement authorities of the conspiracy and participation, and his participation, but it isn't a timely warning or a proper effort to prevent the crime so that there wouldn't be an affirmative defense. I mean, for example, you could inform the authority after the act has occurred.
Well, see, in the end of the duration of the conspiracy provision, it says when the defendant abandons the agreement by advising the person with whom the defendant agreed or informs law enforcement authority. So I think I could say to you, that's it, I'm not conspiring with you anymore, I'm leaving. And that's ending my involvement in the conspiracy, but that would not rise to the level of an affirmative defense to me for prosecution for that offense if I was caught 2 days later and charged.
We'll probably go to 79 now, even though it's confusing, and bring the conspiracy statute back up at the next meeting. I think that there are people here that from out of town wish to testify on it. And
thank you.
Yes, Senator Joseph.
I think you're right. I thought we had put 79 in pretty good shape. I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it is probably that you there are a number of people here which is
I'm wrong.
If I might interject, there are some problems with Senate Bill 79 that remain, and I believe the commissioner does have some remarks to
at this time we are going to take formally up Senate Bill 79. We will bring back up before us the conspiracy bill, hopefully by the end of next meeting.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
you have four. There are some questions you may
Could I make a couple of suggestions?
Please do.
I'm not necessarily crazy about the conspiracy statute, but I think there has been some evidence that we need to do something different, given the change in the environment.
Yeah, would Mr. Caden listen to you at this because he does
work. In preparation for the next meeting, on a theory that we probably will want to do something with that bill, I would like, one, to have staff consider the removal of that section I've been beating to death, because nobody seems to be able to really tell us why it's necessary in this context, other than that it was in the solicitation statute. And two, I'd like to have language, if this is appropriate for me,
it is
language dealing with sexual or other exploitation of a minor for us to consider as well. I mean, I can't, if we're going to do this in the drug cases and if the problem is child protection, and if the argument is that adults use minors as a screen to perpetrate crime, then I think we ought to look at that kind of language too. Otherwise, we'll just have it again next year, I'm sure, and we'll be doing it piecemeal.
Yes,
I take the liberty of the office here. I don't know if you object to that.
I have no objection to the latter. Let me research on my part though. The first suggestion of the removal of what's called C1.
Right, and I wish staff to get our bill drafter and have them work on that section too. The possibility of removal, along with the possibility of some intelligent way of putting together a conspiracy statute that suggested the additions.
What about prostitution?
Yes, prostitution.
Should we keep it a felony, the underlying crime being a felony, and make prostitution, drugs, and sexual
Mr. Chairman, that was going to be my suggestion, that we include those three categories.
Well, thank you. All right, we shall do that. The lady in front in purple was wishing our attention, yes?
Oh, excuse me. Well, I didn't know whether or not you said you were talking about Senate Bill number 79 right now.
Yeah, we're going to go to 79 in a few moments.
Oh, that's what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah. At this time, we're taking up Senate Bill 79, and Ms. Munson is first on the list of witnesses. I would ask that she come forward if she wishes to.
She would rather wait until other people come from that town.
Would you care to come forward since you've attracted my attention? And Sherry Gall here. Oh, Sherry's here. Sherry's next.
Sorry, I didn't mean to come butting in here so abruptly, but I've been running around trying to find out where everything's happening.
Please identify yourself.
Yeah. My name is Harriet Neal. And I'm from the Cooking with Native Association, Vice President, and I'm down here with the Runaway Task Force, Runaway Shelter Task Force, having been involved in it for several months with Marge Hall. And Senate Bill number 79 on the Act relating to runaway minors. This is directly related to the reason why we have the Alaska victim fly-in today, and I was reading through the Act and noticed one thing that brought to mind something I hadn't thought about in several years because my children are all grown. But about 1970s, my son was about 14 and he ran away. We went down to the police station, and you know, they don't take it seriously, runaway children, you know. We filed a police report, we did everything else, and then they acted like, just a kid ran off from home. One of the things I think this bill has to address is for the police people to take it a little more seriously when they have a runaway, because, you know, the parent is concerned, and no telling what will happen to a 14-year-old on the street. And so I feel that when you file a missing persons report, I think that that is cause enough to that it should be taken seriously. And I would like to say that the other thing I'd like to relate here that I think I have been in social services for 20 years, and one of the things that I know is the runaway shelter that is presently run by the Alaska Advocates is overloaded. And when you have overloaded facility, we have to remember we're not thinking about today and tomorrow. We're thinking 20 years down the line. Those kids that we're not taking care of their needs are going to end up being the welfare recipients and the prison people. They're going to end up on welfare or they're going to end up in prison if they aren't corrected and put on the right path to a productive life. So I think that right now, as far as a legislator's job is to help in their capacity as legislators to take care of these needs and take a look at them now rather than use a Band-Aid approach, which becomes pretty expensive piece of Band-Aid 20 years down the line. These same very people that were the runaways are now an added expense to the state of Alaska, whether we're feeding them three meals a day in the prison or on welfare. So it's best to turn the tide right at their most critical years, which is about 14 or 15. And I'm glad to say my son is all right now, and he is taking care of himself in Bellingham. But at the time, you know, it was not very pleasant to get him picked up, go to McLaughlin and all that. And so I think this bill, 79, is one that I'm sure every one of you are in favor of, and I see where you introduced it by all of you people, and I thank you for introducing it, and I know it's not easy to pass a bill, so I thank you for your hard work.
Fine, thank you very much, Harriet. Were there any questions?
Yes.
Could we have them from Sherry Ball, please? Yes, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
For the record, my name is Sherry Ball. I represent the Alaska Women's Lobby. We very much appreciate the sponsor's recognition and concern for the problems of runaway youth. And we do believe that this committee substitute for Senate Bill 79 is more acceptable to us than the original version, and that it will result in the incarceration of fewer youth. We, though, feel that we cannot support legislation which treats the runaways' behavior as delinquent. Labeling runaways as failures or bad kids shifts attention away from what the child is trying to escape their home life. Recent studies indicate that child abuse, both physical and sexual, may play a large part in triggering youth to run away. This is probably more so in the case of those youth who have been committed to the department for temporary placement. Their experiences affect their ability to trust, to remain calm, to feel connected and committed to people and places. By dismissing the runaway's behavior as delinquent, we fail to consider what the act of running away tells us about personal conflicts or a poor family environment. The conventional policy of returning runaways to their home simply allows the chronic runaway to continue the cycle of leaving home. When the runaway's reasons for leaving home are not addressed, the running continues. We believe that the first priority in dealing with runaway adolescents is to provide safety and to meet the youth's needs of food, shelter, and health. There is a need for safe alternative residential environments. Once a safe environment is provided, then assessment and treatment of the youth's problems must begin. Work with the family is critical for those runaways who are able to return to a safe home. Group work with the support of of other youth is particularly useful in a safe institutional setting. Runaways may require multidimensional treatment of attention, anxiety, and potential aggression against towards themselves and others, as well as possible detoxification for alcohol and drug abuse. After the youth is stabilized in a safe environment, then we need to help them to resume basic education and job goals. The older chronic runaway will probably need alternative education and help in achieving economic independence to offset his or her reliance on prostitution and criminal activities for immediate financial support. Programs have been developed in Oregon which provide group homes and pre-emancipation services for those troubled youth who, for one reason or another, cannot successfully be returned to their own or foster homes. We believe it would better serve Alaskan youth and society as a whole to spend our limited state dollars on constructive programs such as these, rather than on incarceration of runaways in juvenile detention facilities. We would urge that consideration of the problem of runaway youth could best be considered in a comprehensive way by the Governor's Interim Commission on Children and Youth, and that this legislation be included in the agenda of the Commission rather than passed into law. Thank you for your consideration.
Any questions? There are no questions. Thank you very much. Dennis Leinhardt testified. Please come forward.
Yes, that's wonderful. My name is Janice Leinhardt, and I'm with the Victims Buy-In and with Mr. Justice. I've been a victim. My whole life has been involved with kids. I've taken in stray kids. I have five of my own, and so I've had a lot of experience with children. And I realize so many of our legislative laws are made to protect the children. And 10 or 20 years ago, I'd have done the same thing. I'd have made these same laws because you want to do everything you can to help these young people so they can get a good start in life, and many of them have been messed up, and you want to do this. And that's why these laws are made the way they are. But now that we've lived this period of time, we're seeing where the results of these laws are leading us. And, I mean, I'm going to give you all, I'll let you copy this packet, but I've got newspaper articles that say teens are becoming more violent, and they're predicting in the 1990s a rise in teen violence. And so there's a lot of things that are starting to happen because we've started taking the deterrent out of things that hurt people. And because we do not allow our young people to be contained, tragedies happen. And I'm one of them. When I think that, I mean, if any of you put yourself in this position, if you're in your home at supper time and somebody knocks on your door and you see a kid at the door, what do you think? You think, you don't know what to think, but you think they need help. And so you let the kid in and the kid pulls a gun on you. Then you, first of all, because it's a kid, you kind of think, well, shockville, you know. And then I know my dad tried to wrestle this kid for the gun when someone else comes in with another gun. Well, my parents are the most kind, gentle people you could ever think of. And so they kept trying to talk to these kids, trying to help them, trying to discouraging this, letting them know they're going to get in trouble for these things. Don't do it. And they lost their lives. Just bingo. Because young people left on the streets are dangerous. They're five times more dangerous than adults. Since my tragedy, I've talked to other people in the same position. One person told me they were a victim of crime, and there was a teenager involved and an adult. And the teenager says, let's kill him, let's kill him. And the adult says, no, I don't want to be in jail the rest of my life. Young people are dangerous. If we truly care for our young people, we're going to make them responsible for their actions. We don't let them run the streets. And if it means we change our constitution, we change our constitution. And I know federally I've got some wonderful information. The Juvenile Justice Bulletin says an overwhelming majority of the authorities interviewed agree that deinstitutionalization has had an adverse effect on the runaway problem. And we in Alaska have to start looking at this. We have more burglaries in our state, and 80% of them are committed by people under the age of 18. If we start stopping these kids at the beginning, there's going to eliminate some of our drug problems, we're going to eliminate some of our burglaries, and we're going to save a lot of those kids' life. Once somebody pays, or once somebody faces the reality of what he's doing, he can be helped. But as long as we mollycoddle them, as long as we try to protect them, they're not going to ever be helped. So it's time that we become many homes. There's no control, there's no directions. Those are five times more dangerous to let those kids be on the street than it is to contain them. Let's be smart people instead of letting the smart people manipulate us. I mean, these young kids who know the system, they have every one of their rights read, and they know how to manipulate them. So by the time they're 18, they're the most seasoned criminals you can think of, because we let them get away with anything. Matter of fact, Boyd, when they picked up Boyd for the murder of my family, you know what his first comment was? I'll beat this one. Because how many years has he beat the system? He knows how to manipulate, and we allow it. It's time that we stand up and care. We stand up and control these young people. And when we start doing that, they're going to be helped. And we're going to save money. We'll save the crowded prisons. I'll bet you dollars to donuts if we start changing these philosophies that we're going to solve some of the overcrowded prisons, we're going to cut down on crime, and we're going to save lives. We can save a lot of people by just saying no. A lot of people will stop, but we've taken every deterrent out, and it's time to put the deterrents back. I mean, that's the hope that we have. And